you for coming. I have to make sure to start on time. I always like to start on time, but I have to really start on time tonight because Mincha is at 8:20. And this is a giant topic, and I want to cover as much of it as I possibly can. As I mentioned before, the source sheets are on the table in the back. Please make sure to sign in. If you received the email that I send out with the source sheets in advance, you don't need to write your email address in. That means I already have it. But I like to be able to send out follow-up emails on the shiur, and for that I need to know who was actually here. If you have a cell phone and if you're able to, please mute it, put it to vibrate, I would appreciate that. Whereas I normally like to have a lot of question and discussion, because we're working with such a tight time frame, I'm actually going to ask people to please hold the questions to the end, recognizing that there may not be time at the end. I davened Mincha already, so I'll be able to stick around afterwards for anyone who can stay to discuss afterwards. The question that we're dealing with is, unfortunately, a very real one, a very practical one. Those who were here on Shabbos at Shalashudis heard Dr. Gabi Elbaz speak about it in terms of her own experience as a victim of an attack, who at one point, when being treated in the hospital, was actually confused for the terrorist, and yet they took care of her, leading to that frightening question of, what if they hadn't? This is a very real, very practical question, and there are strong emotions, surprise, surprise, on both sides of the issue, and with good reason on both sides of the issue. I will likely annoy both, because I think there are substantive sources on both sides of the question. But take a look at your first three sources on the sheets, just to frame it in terms of current events. The first piece from Stuart Weiner, Israeli medics told to treat terrorists the same as victims. This is back in December. Medics at terror sites must treat the wounded according to the severity of their injuries, even if that means helping an attacker before his victims. The Israeli Medical Association said in rules published this week. The new rules formulated by the IMA's Ethics Bureau came into effect at the beginning of the week and replace an earlier directive based on the principle of, quote, charity begins at home, which enabled medical professionals to treat victims first. The Hebrew language Israel Hayom newspaper reported Wednesday. That's your first piece. A dictate that you have to treat everybody according to the severity of their injuries. You follow normal triage regardless of identity of the wounded person. Follow-up article a day later, source number 2, also Times of Israel, Stuart Weiner, volunteer medic group rejects treating terrorists and victims equally. In a statement, Zaka chairman and founder Yehuda Meshi Zahav made it clear that the organization's medics would turn their attention to the victims first, regardless of the injuries sustained by their attacker. Now, this is not news, I imagine. We're familiar with this. Take a look at the third one, though, because I found it very interesting in light of the authors of the article. This is Treating Terrorists and Victims, a Moral Dilemma. It appeared in Lancet, and you look at the three names. The third one is the one that stands out to me, Rabbi Dr. Avram Steinberg. Speaking about the issue, Rabbi Dr. Steinberg is a prominent authority on medical halacha, medical ethics. And he writes, it's part of the paper of which he is a co-author. After treating the Boston Marathon suspected terrorist, the head of emergency medicine at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center admitted, quote, some staff battled second thoughts and anxiety over saving the life of a suspected terrorist. This has also been our experience. It is easy to take to the moral high ground when an issue is purely theoretical, and quite another matter when shock, frustration, and anger enter into play. The Boston example emphasizes the need for unambiguous guidance and a crystal clear message to caregivers confronted with these stressful and emotional circumstances. In our opinion, they continue to say, all patients entering the hospital are unequivocally equal without exception. As difficult as it might be, the medical staff must not be judgmental. Punishment is not the role of the medical staff. Rather, their duty and obligation is to preserve life and restore health. Judgment should be the exclusive providence of the legal system, and physicians should practice their art without discrimination with a clear conscience. No word on whether this adjusted in a society with physician-assisted suicide and how that's involved in addressing this. But the statement that this article makes is that the conclusion is, even though we recognize the angst and the problem involved in treating the terrorists, nonetheless, the guidance that they're giving is to actually treat. You can make, as I said, logical arguments for treating and for not treating. Right, the arguments for treating, and again, for those who came in late, I'm going a little bit quickly with this and not doing this in our usual sort of question-answer mode because of time. But the logical arguments in favor of treating: a doctor's duty is to treat. You don't want to make the doctor into judge, jury, and executioner. You don't know, as seen in Dr. Elbaz's case, you don't necessarily even know who you have on the operating table. You don't necessarily know that this is a terrorist. And what are you going to... And so on. We'll get some of the other arguments as we go through it. On the other hand, the argument in response is both the point about the angst of the physicians and the fact that there's a reason why the terrorist is injured. The terrorist wanted to be injured. He did it to himself. And now we're going to go treat him and restore him to life because he tried to kill us and blew himself up in the process. It's a very difficult thing to do. So because we're dealing with such a difficult, complicated question, it seems to me that a good way to address it is actually to break this down into five separate questions. Not in terms of varying the question, but in terms of varying the audience. And so you will see, as you look through the source sheets, they write stapled them. Not quite clear on that. Okay. As you look through the source sheets, we're going to start by addressing the question to the physician. If someone were just looking at it from a medical perspective as a doctor, what do the Jewish sources say about that? Then move on to the question of a dayan, a judge on a Beit Din, a judge on a religious court. What would the judge on the religious court have to say? Then third, a soldier, looking at it from a purely military perspective. What makes sense? Then fourth, the prime minister, politician. From a politician's perspective, what would the Torah give as guidance to a politician before concluding, last, with probably in the middle of Ashrei at that point, nonetheless, the humanitarian. How do you address this from a humanitarian perspective? And all of these from within Torah sources, the way in which Torah would frame these five different outlooks. Clear? Okay. So let's get started. The first is the physician, and what would the doctor have to say about this? So we are familiar with source number 4, classic, the Talmud statement that there is permission for doctors to heal. Right? The Torah says that in the event that person A wounds person B, person A is responsible to pay for all sorts of damage and restitution, including medical bills, from which the Talmud says, well, if there's an idea of paying medical bills for the victim, obviously that means that there's such a thing as a doctor. Otherwise, who are you paying your medical bills to? We see that there's permission for doctors to heal. And the classic question on this passage in the Talmud is, why do you need permission to heal at all? We have all sorts of commandments about taking care of other people. We are told to restore people's lost property to them. We are told to love our neighbor as ourselves. We're told not to stand by as somebody's blood is shed. Of course I'm supposed to heal people. Why do you need to give permission to a physician? Rashi, classic commentator on the Talmud, offers one explanation. He says it's because when it comes to medical illness, one might view it as a wound from God, something God has done to the patient, and I might say it's hubris. I'm going to now heal somebody if God injured them, and therefore the Talmud says, no, you have permission to heal. That's one way to look at it. Another way is Ramban Nachmanides, who says that it's because every medical treatment involves potential side effects and pitfalls, it's possible that you're going to actually make things worse when you try to treat somebody, and therefore the Talmud says you have permission anyway. even though medical treatment is uncertain. And so we understand that there is such a thing as a role of the doctor, and that it is in fact encouraged. Despite the pitfalls and despite what can go wrong, we encourage you nonetheless to go out and heal. And that obligation to heal, I wanted to underscore this because I get this question disturbingly often. That obligation to heal includes everybody, Jews and non-Jews alike. If you take a look at source number 5, Rambam Maimonides says it in one context. He talks about the obligation that Jews have to the community around them, and one of the obligations that he talks about is levaker cholehem, to visit the sick. Now, the truth is, I fell into the trap that everybody falls into when they translate the phrase bikur cholim. We always translate bikur cholim as visiting the sick, but that's not what it actually means. I should not have translated it as visit. What does bikur cholim actually mean? To attend to them, to examine them, to see to their needs. Bikur is not a reference to visiting at all. It's to take care of them. That's what we're actually talking about. And he says, Maimonides says, that's one's obligation. He quotes two verses. The first verse that he quotes is, God is good to all and his mercy is upon all of his creations. And the second one is, that the Torah's paths are pleasant paths and all of her ways are peace. In other words, there are two reasons, he says, why we do it. Number one, because you're supposed to have mercy on everybody, just like God does. And number two, for the sake of peace within society, you don't want a situation in which the fact that you prefer to take care of your family first ends up leading to disruptions in general social relations. And further, Maimonides in source number 6, the Rambam writes that if there is a non-Jew who observes the 7 Noahide laws, doesn't kill, doesn't steal, and so on, then you have a basic mitzvah of keeping him alive, and you should go out and heal him, and you should not charge, and so on. So there is a role of a doctor, and the role of the doctor is to heal. Charging for medicine is a separate lecture, which we talked about a while back, and I'd be glad to discuss later if people want. Yes, you're allowed to charge. Don't worry. There is such a thing as a role of the physician, and there is an obligation for the physician to treat patients. In truth, there is a reduced obligation to a certain extent where a patient declines help. Where a patient says, thank you, but no thank you. There is something of a reduced obligation on the part of the physician. So, for example, to take something out of context, in source number 7, the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law says, there is a mitzvah of restoring someone's lost property. However, if a person destroys his own property knowingly, he takes something that's valuable and he leaves it outside by the curb, where it could be stolen, damaged by rain, whatever it is, you're under no obligation to haul it back to his front door and leave it and bring it into his home for him. If someone is going to be careless, knowing full well, you're not obligated to protect his property on his behalf. And so the same argument can be made regarding restoring someone's health to him. The argument comes up also, not in a medical case, but in the case of burial. I brought you source number 8, a passage from the Talmud, where if a person declares that he doesn't want his own assets used to bury him, he says, forget it, don't want a funeral. So the rule is, we don't listen to him. He's not entitled to say, I want my kids to inherit more money. So what we do is, we don't listen to him, we do bury him, and we'll use his money in order to do so. That's what we do. So there is a little bit of tension here. On the one hand, we're gonna make sure to take care of him. On the other hand, we're also gonna use his funds to do it. So the question then becomes, here you have a terrorist, you have somebody who, and again, we're not getting into the question, the very important question of how can you identify a terrorist? How do you know that this is the right person? That's an important question in its own right. However, let's say you do know. You know full well. Do you as a physician have a duty to heal? So again, just the pure physician's perspective, not the judge on the Beit Din, we're getting to him next, not the soldier. Just from a pure physician's perspective, you have somebody who tried to blow himself up. He didn't care about his own health. Do you have an obligation to take care of him? The general understanding is that it's a reduced obligation. However, there is still an obligation to heal. Except, there's one caveat to it. And the caveat to it is that there may be a distinction between there may be a distinction between a person who says, I don't want to be taken care of, and even does something to harm himself, as the terrorist did, and somebody who injured himself in trying to kill me, in trying to actually hurt me. In other words, the fact that it came about not by an act against himself, that the fact that it came about instead by an act of aggression towards me may mean that he forfeits his rights to his to medical care. You follow what I'm saying? I'm going a little bit more quickly, perhaps, than is wise. Let me make sure that I spell this out. The fact that it's possible for a person to forfeit rights. I'm sorry. The fact that a person who harms himself does not normally forfeit his right to my protection doesn't necessarily apply if you're dealing with somebody who hurts himself in the course of trying to hurt me. In the event that he hurt himself while trying to hurt me, maybe he's not entitled to my medical care. When we say, as Maimonides said, Rachamav al kol ma'asav, God's mercy is upon all of his creations, does that necessarily mandate that I endanger myself in order to take care of somebody who might turn around and, benefiting from my help, attack me? That's where it becomes a little bit less clear. I'm going to come back to that a little bit more when we talk about the judge in the next segment. But what I want to suggest at this point is, from a purely medical perspective, the obligation of the doctor to heal does apply when you're dealing with patients who have harmed themselves, but may not apply when the patient harmed himself in trying to hurt the physician himself. Are we clear? Understood? Okay. The second piece is when you get to the dayan, when you get to the judge. And here we come squarely to the issue of the rodef. A rodef is a pursuer, somebody who attempted to harm somebody else. Until he blew himself up, this person, or tried to stab someone, or whatever case you want to give, this person was a rodef, which means someone who is trying to kill us. And the rule ordinarily is that if somebody is trying to kill you, hashkem lahargo, you're supposed to rise early to kill him first. Until the moment when he carried out the attack, forget medical care, I would have been justified in striking first. And so the question is, does he lose that status as a rodef once he has carried out the attack? Does that end once he is incapacitated? Or does that status continue? So again, it will be great to have this as a discussion, but I'm going to go with the sources that we have on this. We have precedent for the idea of viewing enmity as permanent, and saying that no, he does not lose the status of pursuer of rodef. Source number 9 requires some explanation, which I'll provide outside of the text. The beginning of Parshat Bishalach in the Torah, we find that the Jews are fleeing Egypt. Paro goes racing after them. Paro has with him chariots drawn by what?
Horses.
Problem. Just before that, there had been a plague of hail, and it had wiped out the animals. Where in the world did he get horses? Answer, the Torah says, Hayarei et Devar Hashem, those who feared the word of God, meaning those who thought there really is going to be a plague, they brought their animals inside. So what Paro has for his chariots are the horses which were owned by the people who believed in God. Those are the ones who are now chasing after the Jews to kill them. Leading the Midrash, quoted by Tosfot in source number 9, to say, this is the behavior of the good guys. The good Egyptians are the ones who believed what God was saying. They're the ones who are now going to turn their horses to attack us. And so he says, don't trust any of them. He hates you, he's always hated you, and he's going to hate you in the future. That's the statement that Tosfot makes in source number 9. You find a similar comment in source number 10, Ralbag, Rabbi Levi ben Gershom. He's dealing with the case of Amalek, where we find in the Torah, in the prophets, that Amalek forever comes back to attack us. Over and over again, you find Amalek attacking us. You don't lose the status of a rodef, of a pursuer, and therefore, even if he is subdued right now, whether he ends up even going to jail and serving 30 years in jail, after that, he's going to come out and attack you. And therefore, he doesn't lose the status of being a pursuer. That's the argument in favor of saying, don't treat. However, still not exactly clear. There has to be a certain threshold of certainty that this person actually would attack again. Or to put it differently, if you have someone who in Hebrew we would call a safek rodef, someone who might be a pursuer, but we don't actually know. Are you going to view that, not because we don't know the identity now, we're talking about where we know that the person was the one who attacked the first time, but you don't necessarily know that that person would do it again. Can you really assume that that person is a rodef, is a pursuer, when you don't know for sure? So this actually has applications in various areas of Jewish law, various areas of halacha, and there is a running debate between Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach and Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach took the position that you don't need certainty in order to brand somebody rodef. He says, look, the Torah says that if somebody, it's in source number 11, if somebody invades a person's home, we're told that the homeowner is allowed to defend himself by killing the invader. He's allowed to take the life of the invader on the assumption that the invader would kill him. That in the event that he stood up and tried to stop him, the invader would kill him. So Rabbi Orbach says, you don't know that for sure. You don't have certainty. Nonetheless, it's considered to be justified. That's the position of Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach. You don't need to know with certainty. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, in source number 12, disagrees. He's dealing with a very different case. He's dealing with the case of abortion, where there's a fetus that is considered to be a threat to the mother's life. And he says, you need to have certainty in order to be able to abort. Now, the truth of the matter is that that's a very different case. Because the fetus is not an established aggressor. It's a mindless entity that is causing harm, but isn't trying to. Whereas you're dealing with a home invasion, or you're dealing with a terrorist, this is somebody who has a track record already, and is an aggressor. Nonetheless, what you see here is a debate. How sure do I have to be when the judge hears this case in court? We're no longer doctors, now we're judges. When the judge hears this case, hypothetically, right? The doctor is asking the judge, do I treat or not treat? The judge says, well, we have a principle that once someone attacks you and wants to kill you, you assume that that status remains. But do you require some level of certainty? Rabbi Orbach says no. Rabbi Feinstein says yes. It's a very interesting question. A question which has an additional dimension to it. Let's say you say this person is not a rodef. Let's say they're not pursuing me. Let's say I have knowledge that the person is not going to pursue me to kill me anymore. Nonetheless, let's say the person was successful in killing somebody. That makes them already a murderer. Is the murderer entitled to have me save the murderer's life? The answer is not necessarily. Not necessarily. There's a lot of discussion about this. There was a case that came up a few centuries ago. A woman poisoned her husband, killed her husband, and she herself became ill from the poison. And the question was, so what do we do in terms of treating her? Do we actually save her? There's a passage in the Talmud which is brought in the Sefer Hasidim in source number 13, dealing with a case in which a murderer comes to you and says, hide me, take care of me. And Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid in source number 13 says, no, you don't accept him, you don't protect him, you don't try to help. A person who is a murderer is not entitled to your protection. And so, for the dayan, for the perspective of the judge, I think it's actually reasonable to argue that the judge would say no. Don't treat. Number one, because this is a person who pursues, and as a pursuer is not entitled to your protection. And number two, this is a person who is a murderer, even if they're not currently a pursuer. From that pure perspective, and again, assuming knowledge that this is really the person and so forth, I think it's possible that the judge would say, no, don't take care. So we have the doctor, the medical perspective, which is less clear, but I think is also inclined to say purely he's not entitled to your care. You have the judge, who potentially could say the same thing, keeping in mind Rabbi Feinstein's position, who says you need to know that the person is a rodev. But the argument is there. What about a soldier, shifting to our third position? What would the military perspective be? So one argument that's been offered, and I've read it in the press in various articles, is let him die, it's a deterrent. Let him die. He's if they know that not only can they attack us, but when they attack us, we're now going to protect them and keep them alive, then that's just an incentive for them to attack, because they know they have a safety net. The truth of the matter is, the argument could go the other way, frankly. Rabbi Yaakov Ariel, in source number 15, says, maybe he wants to be a martyr. You're not necessarily doing him a favor by saving his life. It could be that his goal is actually martyrdom, and therefore you're not necessarily doing him a favor. And further, he says dying may not be a deterrent, because if he dies, he becomes a martyr, and then they have more reason to attack, because they like to attack to avenge martyrs. So therefore, you haven't actually necessarily made a wise military decision at all. Far from being a deterrent, you may have actually spurred more attacks. That's an interesting argument. The other argument that's brought in terms of saying not to save the life is that this is war. And during war, you don't have an obligation to go looking for people to save on the other side. He's a soldier for the enemy. Rav Dov Lior in Israel has said this regarding terrorists. You don't have an obligation to look out for them. It's an interesting argument that Rav Lior makes. I brought it for you in number 16 on the sheet. He says, an attacking terrorist comes in the name of his nation. His goal is to strike any Jew in any way. And that's the way Rav Lior distinguishes between a terrorist and a random criminal. The criminal has a particular goal in mind. The terrorist says, any Jew, any way, I can do it. I don't particularly care who it is. So he says, when there's an attack like that, it's considered not a criminal act, but a war against the Jewish nation. It's an interesting argument. However, not so clear-cut. And the reason it's not so clear-cut, and I have to credit Rabbi Baruch Weintraub for pointing out this source to me, take a look at number 18. From Rabbi Yaakov Ariel. He says, you have to be really careful about what you do under the heading of war. And here I'm going to read it out because I think it's a very important point. It's my translation in the English. War, specifically because it has a public character, must be run by the government or some authorized public agency and not by individual people. Further, the success of a war depends, first of all, upon the individual's loyalty to the communal structure. Overthrowing the communal structure endangers the community and individual alike. The Netziv, Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, went on at length to explain, based on this assumption, many laws relating to a state of emergency. In his view, one who disobeys an order during a state of emergency is considered a rodef and is liable for death. He says, if you're going to call this war, then you have to be willing to listen to your commands. You can't decide, I've decided the best way to wage the war is, I'm going to kill this guy. If the instructions are don't, then the answer is follow your instructions. However, he then backtracks a little bit. He says, yes, but no. There has to be some room for people to use their own seichel, their own mind, and take their own initiative. He says, look in Tanakh, when Sisera, the Canaanite general, is killed by Yael, She didn't have orders to go ahead and execute Sisera. She knew that was what was needed at the time. There does have to be some room and some element of flexibility, so it's not entirely clear-cut. I think the military decision is not at all clear. I don't think that you can argue on one side or the other. The argument on the side of letting him die as a deterrent has the response that letting him die may not deter anything and may in fact spur more attacks. The argument of this is war, and therefore I should let him die, he's an enemy soldier, does not necessarily hold water either. Clear? Are we somewhat clear? Okay. We've seen the doctor. We've seen the judge. And we've seen the soldier. But everybody here in this room, I hope, has been thinking that we're missing a key perspective here. And that's the perspective of the politician. Because you can't ignore the political weight of what happens. I mean, we've seen the debacle that happened with the soldier in Hebron. The issue of what is the world going to say and how do we handle things politically is a substantive problem. So what would a politician say if the politician were working from Jewish sources? Well, a politician has a few different obligations. It's not only about diplomacy. The politician's first obligation may be, as an administrator, to say, we have limited resources. You're going to use a bed in the ER for the terrorist? You're going to use a bed in the ICU for a terrorist? I mean, what happens when other people need the bed in the ICU? Are you really going to deny them the bed, a taxpaying citizen who has been a teacher or whatever it is, because the terrorist is now in a bed in the ICU? So that's a very difficult thing to do. We have triage rules within Jewish law, and those tend to give precedence to the person who is valuable for society. It's a key point. Triage rules, from a Jewish perspective, tend to value first the person who is valuable to society. So, for example, a soldier in the IDF has higher priority for treatment and the expenditure of resources in order to safeguard them. In the case of an epidemic, healthcare workers will have a higher priority for care in order to protect them. So maybe the argument should be, like Zaka says, let's put our civilians and their medical needs ahead of the needs of the terrorist. That's one potential political argument. Now, some will mention on the other side of this that there are international agreements, Geneva Convention and so forth. And we have the principle of honoring our agreements. Perhaps the most famous example from Tanakh is the story of the Givonim. The Givonim come to the Jews in Sefer Shoftim, the Book of Judges. They claim that they are from far away. They're not in any wars with Joshua. They're not part of his mission. And it turns out that they are actually the Chivi who live right next door. And they are indeed on Joshua's hit list, which is a longer discussion in its own right. He's not supposed to make treaties with them. But he doesn't find that out until he has promised them protection and an alliance. The result being that Yoshua says, I'm going to stick to my deal. I made a deal, I'm going to honor the deal. And when the Givonim are attacked by their Canaanite neighbors, Yoshua goes to their defense. The famous war in which he stops the sun, Shemesh v'Givon Dom, that's that war. In defense of Givon, in defense of these dishonest people. We do have an obligation to honor our agreements. However, the obligation to honor our agreements ends if the other side breaks the rules. Meaning, the Geneva Convention is not in favor of terrorism, right? Blowing up buses, knifing civilians, and so on. And therefore, the argument can be made, they have suspended their rights to any sort of protection. I brought you a precedent for it from the Talmud in source number 22, but I'm not going to see it inside. You can see it. The other point, which is brought in number 23, in an article, Does Human Rights Law Apply to Terrorists, from the Middle East Quarterly, the author notes that the Geneva Convention only applies for its signatories. And the terrorists are not signatories to the Geneva Convention. and therefore all the nice protections that are given are not relevant. And you can see it in number 23. So the second political argument, the first political argument is we have to administer our resources and give it to the higher valued members of society before we're going to give it to some terrorist. That's an argument in favor of not treating. The second argument is in favor of treating, saying we're part of these international agreements, and you do have to honor them, with a caveat that you don't have to honor them with somebody who is himself breaking the rules or not a party to them in the first place. There's a third concern, and this is always very painful when you get to this source. The third concern is the concern for Chilul Hashem, desecrating God's name. And saying that if this action is going to cause the world to say we are barbaric, then that in and of itself is reason not to engage in that activity. Now, whether I am or I'm not worried about that, you may also want to take into consideration the line from Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik after the 67 war, in which he said that one of the things the nations learned in the 67 war is that Jewish blood is not cheap. That we will indeed defend ourselves. So there's also that piece of what you want the world to know and what you want the world to say, and that shouldn't be discounted. But take a look at number 24, because this is a very painful source to read when you look at the name. The author of this piece is Rabbi Yehuda Herzl Henkin, whose son, Eitam, and daughter-in-law were killed on Sukkot of this year in front of their children by terrorists. So you keep that in mind. He wrote this before that. This was written before that happened. But he writes, in truth, there is desecration of God's name even with actions that are legal and even during war. Even if the treaties justify me not helping the terrorist, nonetheless, that can still desecrate God's name. And he refers to the story of the Givonim, the Gibeonites that I just mentioned. That it says, the children of Israel did not strike them, for the leaders of the nation had sworn it to them. And the Talmud says, the oath was not truly binding, because it was under false pretenses, but they still did not kill them, quote, because of the sanctity of the name, of God's name. And Rashi explained, lest the idolaters say that Israel had violated their oath. So Rabbi Henkin comes down on the side of saying that you take care of the terrorist, that you would indeed take care of him. There's another factor within this political calculation, and that's something called Eva. Eva is enmity. And enmity is a practical calculation for us when we make our decisions. In source number 25, Rabbi Yitzhak Zilberstein, who is a prominent authority in medical halacha in Israel today, brings this, I don't want to say bizarre story, but a story I've certainly never heard of, and it sounds kind of interesting. In number 25, he's speaking there regarding the question of taking care of the terrorists or not taking care of them. And look in his second paragraph. He says, it is known that generations ago, permission was granted by the nations to Jews to bring the Korban Pesach on the site of the Beit HaMikdash. I don't know of any moment in time when the governing authority, the time he's referring to, you'll see in a moment, he refers to the Beis Halevi being from then. So you mean, what he's saying is the end of the Ottoman Empire is what you'd be talking about. The end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th. So he says, there was a time when they were willing to allow us to bring the Korban Pesach. When the matter was brought before the leaders of Israel, they dealt with the halachic questions tied to bringing the Korban Pesach today. And they say that the great Beis Halevi said, I could find answers for all of these questions and permit bringing the Korban Pesach, but I could not find permission for the shedding of the blood of a single Jew by the Muslims because of the Korban Pesach. In other words, he says, I want to bring the Korban Pesach. I can justify it as a matter of Jewish law. We don't know who's a Kohen, and people are impure, and I don't know exactly what site is the proper site for the temple, and so I could answer all those questions, he says, but you know that someone's going to get angry because we did it, and they're going to attack us. And on that basis, he opposes it. Now, as I said, the historicity of this story is unclear to me. But he brings it as an argument for saying you have to be very careful about that in the event that you are not going to in the event that you are not going to treat the terrorist. On the other side, because there's, as we're seeing, always another side, Rav Moshe Feinstein dealt with an interesting question. A question I've come across from time to time. Someone approached Rabbi Feinstein with a question. He had a non-Jewish neighbor. The non-Jewish neighbor saw the mezuzah on his door and said, "I'd like one of those. Would you put up a mezuzah for me?" So the fellow comes to Rabbi Feinstein and asks him, what's the rule? I brought you his response in number 26. Rabbi Feinstein says, you have to be concerned for enmity if your actions would lead someone to want to hurt us, or potentially could lead to desire to hurt us. But he distinguishes between the two layers. He says, if your action would actually cause someone to want to attack Jews, then you can't go that route. Even if it means violating prohibitions, you can't go that route. You're not allowed to do something that will cause someone to want to attack Jews. That's his statement. Whereas if it could lead eventually to an enmity that could go, he says that's a lesser layer of enmity. So taking Rabbi Feinstein's statement here, would failure to treat the terrorist lead someone out there to want to attack Jews? What do you think? I hear a yes, I hear a no. To my mind, it's a no, simply because even those who disagree with the decision have to understand where it comes from. It's not as though it's inhuman to say, this person wanted to kill me, I'm not interested in expending my medical resources on him ahead of my civilians. Whether you agree with it or not, it's not unthinkable to take that stance. In part, yes. In part, it is the recruiting issue. But I think the overall image that comes out of these discussions of the political issues is that that politician's stance is going to have to be very complicated. From a medical perspective, going back to our beginning, from medical perspective, you can make the solid argument that there's no obligation purely medically. You can make that point because he surrendered his right to your medical care when he tried to attack you. You can make the argument regarding the judge that he'll say this person is a pursuer and he remains a pursuer. That argument can be made with some caveats, as we saw. When it comes, though, to the military calculation and the political calculation from the halachic sources, it becomes a lot more challenging, both in terms of the military perspective of, is this right behavior in a time of war? And from the politician's perspective, in terms of, on the one hand, the triage of resources and saying, I don't want to spend my resources on him, but on the other hand, and also the international agreements, and also the concern for Eva, for enmity and Chil Hashem, desecration of God's name. And then, on the other side, they're not party to these agreements and they're violating the agreements. What right do they have to my protection? But I think the politician is a lot more complicated. The last item, the case of the pure humanitarian, and then Jeff is going to have an announcement to make at the end. Please make sure to hear that as well. But the pure humanitarian. We noted already the doctor may not be obligated to heal. But doctors, generally speaking, do want to heal. That's why you go into medicine, is in order to take care of people. And we have many sources that would seem to indicate that that's our imperative. That's what we ought to do. The Talmud has a line, it's a classic, I brought it in number 27, that one of the three traits for which Jews are known is that we are supposed to be merciful people. That's a hallmark of our identity. Source number 28, Rabbi David Stav, says it's important to maintain our moral superiority, to avoid harming a person who is not involved in murderous activity, to avoid harming those who have already been neutralized and no longer pose a danger. It's not because they're innocent, he says. They deserve to die, but that is not our way, he argues. So he makes the argument that we don't do it. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein as well, in source number 29, makes the point about the toll that war takes on us. On the other hand, because again, there's always another hand, you can't forget that helping them does potentially expose us to harm. You can't get out of that. It's a reality. Harming them could well I'm sorry, helping them could well expose Hasdam. I brought you Rabbi David Kimchi in source number 30, where he makes the statement, "Hachamla al harsha'im achzariyut." He says, mercy on the wicked is fundamentally cruelty. And so that argument will be brought on the other side. So I think the humanitarian perspective is also a terribly complicated and difficult one. I don't think it's straightforward. You know, I had people I spoke to in the days before I gave this who were very strong on both sides. People who were very strong in saying you have to treat, you have to be able to get past it. And then people on the other hand saying, absolutely not, you should never treat. And do unto them as they would do unto you. And statements of that nature. And I'm not, as you can hear, I'm not offering black and white answers because it's not a black and white issue. But I think, and I hope, what we've seen here is that whichever of these so-called pure views you try to take, whether you take the pure medical decision, whether you take the pure judicial decision of the dayan, of the judge, whether you take the military decision, the political decision, or the humanitarian decision, there really are critical factors on either side, and therefore this is something that really bears a lot of thought. I thank you for bearing with me when I didn't do all the usual question and answer, which I like to do. Order of events from here. We have 5 minutes, I think, until Mincha, roughly. What we're going to do is Jeff is going to make an announcement. I think Dr. Elbaz is here. So after Jeff speaks, Dr. Elbaz will have a chance to say something about her experience. Is that... I'll do the Q&A. All right, so I'll be able to take questions for those who don't need to go to Mincha, because I already davened, and then Dr. Elbaz will speak as well. Thank you very much. Jeff first, and if you didn't sign in, please make sure that you sign in before going, because I'd like to be able to send out follow-up on this.